This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. After you clean out your closets and drawers or downsize to a smaller home, what happens to the clothes, furniture, and electronics you drop off at the Goodwill or your neighborhood thrift store? More specifically, what happens to the stuff they can't sell? And there's plenty of it. My guest, Adam Minter, has tried to find out the answer by traveling to the places where secondhand goods are collected, bought, repurposed, repaired, and sold in the U.S., Asia, and Africa. He's the author of the new book, Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. His previous book, Junkyard Planet, was about the recycling industry. Three generations of his family were in the junk business. He's reported on the waste and recycling industries for nearly two decades. He's now a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and is based in Malaysia. Adam Minter, welcome back to Fresh Air. I interviewed you after your previous book, Junkyard Planet, was published. And in preparing for the interview today, I read that your mother died 2 weeks after publication of that book. So I don't know. I think I probably spoke to you before that. Anyways, I'm sorry. You talk about this in the book in the way that it's relevant to the book, in that you were living in a small apartment in Shanghai at the time. And after your mother died, like, you couldn't take her stuff to your home. There was no room. It was too far away. And that was one of the things that got you thinking a lot about reuse.
Yeah, it was. I remember it quite clearly. She was at the reading that we had in St. Paul, and a few days later, she passed away. And, you know, what happened is what happens to a lot of American families. There's sort of two periods of grieving in a way. There was the grieving of my mother passing, but then you're sort of left with the material legacy of her life, you know, her property, the things that were in her small apartment, the things that we found out were stored in relatives' basements. And it became the responsibility of my sister and I to figure out what to do with those things. And neither of us really were in a position to take anything. She lived in a small apartment in New York, as you said. I was in Shanghai. And so it took over a year of us coming in and out of town occasionally, you know, giving things away, maybe taking a piece or, you know, something, a picture out of the boxes. And finally, we got to the end of it and we were left staring at her china. And neither of us wanted to let it go because we knew she loved that china. And it was sort of a, you take it, no, you take it, no, you take it. And finally, we said, let's take it to the Goodwill. And when we were, you know, waiting to drop that off in the drive-through drop-off at the Goodwill in Hopkins, Minnesota, it occurred to me that this is probably the start of a book.
Do you know what happened to the china?
Well, I didn't. I was sitting there thinking, you know, I don't know what happens to this. I follow waste and recycling all over the world. That's what I've been covering for years. But I don't know actually what happens once that china goes through that door. And so it occurred to me, this is a very interesting subject, and I'm probably the person to do it. And so I started talking to people about, you know, if they knew what happened to that stuff. And nobody really knew what happened beyond the donation door at Goodwill.
Yeah, and I just want to say about that, for all of us who have somebody in the family who died, you know, you go through their stuff. The stuff that you give away, you want to really believe that, like, it's going to find a good home, you know, because yeah. You feel like your parent or, you know, whoever cared about it, it was a part of their lives. You don't want to just, like, put it in the trash. And on the other hand, what are you going to do with it? So, you give it to the thrifter and then, like, you never know. But it has a special meaning and you want to think it found a good home. So as part of your research for this book, you went to a Goodwill in Arizona where people were bringing in carloads of stuff from the flea market because they couldn't sell it at the flea market. So these are the things that, like, nobody really wanted to buy them. Now they're
right.
All at the Goodwill. So what are the standards at Goodwill and Salvation Army and, you know, private thrift stores that you went to? Because they don't keep everything that we give them.
No, and that's exactly what I did. I literally sat on a chair sometimes at the donation door at Goodwill in Tucson, Arizona, and watched the stuff come through the door. And it's amazing the things that come through the door at Goodwill. And I would literally follow it, walk with it, you know, to the sorting areas. And it was really surprising to me. I didn't know what I was expecting, but I didn't expect the level of sophistication of sorting that you find at a Goodwill. You know, I think we just sort of think of of it as, well, whatever's trash, they'll throw in the trash, and then the rest of it gets put on the shelves. But they're very sophisticated about how they price these things for the community that surrounds the particular Goodwills. They, you know, look at the quality of the objects, decide if certain things belong at their boutiques. Goodwill increasingly has sort of a higher-end, secondhand outlet, you know, within their system, and so they can maybe price the stuff higher and make more money from it. So they really know what they're doing, and the level of knowledge of what we throw away is extraordinary. I mean, I think of them almost as anthropologists, the sorters in those rooms. But the astonishing thing to me was, even with all that sophistication of sorting, your average thrift store in the United States only sells about 1/3 of the stuff that ends up on its shelves, and the rest of the stuff ends up somewhere else.
How do they sort it to decide what's going to the trash or the landfill and what's happening to the rest of it?
Sure. Well, let's use apparel as an example. If you go to the donation rooms and sorting rooms that I spent time in Tucson, you know, there'll be, you know, large carts full of clothing, and they will go to sorters who, first of all, sort of have they have almost like a flow chart. It's a list of brands. There'll be some, I think it's around 85 to 90 brands on there. And they will tell the sorters how to price those. But on top of that, they go through and they feel the fabric. You know, is it thin? Does it feel like something that's going to fall apart after 1 to 5 washes? And that's really important, because you can tell these sorters there's a brand here and it should be priced $2.99. But the sorters will tell you, you know, these brands are declining in quality. And I had that conversation over and over. They would refer to a brand and say, well, it used to be a pretty good $2.99 brand, meaning we'd price it at $2.99, but we really feel it now because it's not as good as it was when it was first labeled $2.99. And when that happens, it'll go into perhaps a bin that isn't designed to go out to the store, but it might go to what is called an as-is bin, which would be something that's sold to a rag maker or maybe sold as stuffing, recycled in that sense. It's not recycled for use. And then you will go through there and you will find garments that simply don't even belong going to the rag makers or the stuffing. That may be something like undergarments. That may be something that's just so badly soiled that, you know, you couldn't in good conscience send it to anybody, so it would go into the trash bin. So it's a very, you know, there's an objective side to it, but there's also sort of the subjective side that requires the sorters in these rooms, just talking about apparel, to use their subjective knowledge that they've acquired as they spend time with thousands and thousands of garments over periods of time, you know, to make that call.
So if a sorter determines that an article of clothing or a blanket or whatever is no longer usable, but it can be recycled for like rags or stuffing, does the fabric make a difference in what the afterlife is going to be? Is cotton going to be recycled differently than polyester or vegan leather?
The answer to that is yes. I always have wanted to report on what's called the rag industry, and it's I call them the original recyclers, and they've existed for a couple hundred years as an industrial enterprise. These are companies that take old clothes, old hospital gowns, old bed sheets, and they cut them up into rags that are then sold to everyone from hotels and bars to wipe down counters to car washes to wipe down your windshield, and it's usually the last use of a garment or a bed sheet. And historically, they haven't really had to worry that much about the quality of the fabric coming through their doors. Fabric that may be bought from thrift stores, may be bought from hospitals, may be bought from hotels. But in the last few years, that's changed. And it's changed because clothing became cheaper. And the way it became cheaper, one of the ways it became cheaper, is that manufacturers started weaving polyester into the cotton. And if you talk to rag makers, and it's a really big industry in the United States and around the world, it handles probably 1/3 of the clothing that's tossed out every year. If you talk to them, they'll tell you it used to be that you get something labeled 100% cotton, and it really was 100% cotton. But increasingly, 100% cotton doesn't mean 100% cotton. And that has a real impact on the recycling. So if you make a rag that, say, has some polyester in it with that cotton, and you sell it to, say, an oil and gas company to wipe down leaks. As we all know, polyester picks up static electricity, and so that becomes an explosion risk.
So what happens to all the polyester clothes? How are they recycled? Are they used for stuffing?
So in many cases, yeah, they're used for stuffing. And there is, you know, that's another side of, you could say, the rag industry is there is a large stuffing industry. And so polyester clothes can, you know, serve as great stuffing material, you know, like chairs and sofas.
So every step along the way in the world of recyclables, stuff is weeded out for use and other stuff is sent to the next destination because nobody at the previous destination could figure out a use for it. So where do the goods go to die at the end of this long run?
Yeah. I mean, they end up in the landfill or the incinerator. I mean, there is no green heaven, if you will. Everything wears out eventually and everything gets tossed out. I mean, you know, we don't have many artifacts and many things that have, you know, were, you know, from the colonial period in the United States that are in daily use anymore. They're in museums or they're in, you know, colonial landfills, if you will. And that's, you know, and that's the fate of stuff. That's the fate of our consumerist societies. You know, if we spend our time thinking, you know, this is going to be used perpetually forever, even the best made garment, you know, the most robust smartphone, we're deluding ourselves a bit. Eventually, everything has to die. And that's sort of the dark side of consumerism. Certainly, metals can be recycled over and over. But you even lose a little bit of metal every time in the recycling process. So it's sort of the ultimate story of consumerism. And it's the dark side. We can't really dilute ourselves into thinking everything lasts forever.
Does it make environmental sense that the goods that can't be sold in the thrift stores in the U.S., many of them get exported to distant countries, and they might get exported yet again to another country after that? I mean, when you think of all of the fuel being used to transport these possessions, former possessions, the stuff. I mean, does that make sense?
It does. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is we know just from doing what is called a life cycle assessment of products. A life cycle assessment is basically where somebody goes and looks at the full environmental impact of a product, say a smartphone, from manufacturing to disposal, and, you know, looks at what the air pollution impacts are, the mining impacts, the carbon impacts. And the one thing we do know is that the biggest impact of most products is the manufacturing side. And so if you want to reduce the environmental impact of your consumption, the best way to do that is to not manufacture more stuff. In that sense, the best thing you can do is not buy more stuff. And so the longer that your product lasts, the longer that you use that smartphone, the less likely it is that you're going to be buying a new one. So the goal really should be to keep your stuff in use for as long as possible, whether it's by you or somebody in Ghana or somebody in Cambodia. So in that sense, it's a really good thing, because if somebody in Cambodia is using your phone, they're probably not buying a new cheap handset there. In terms of the shipping, that's a really interesting story. And one of the reasons why you've seen globalization of recycling and reuse work over the years is because people are buying so much new stuff. Let me give China as an example. You know, during the boom years of sort of the China-U.S. recycling trade, you saw so much U.S. recycling move to China, in part because China was sending so many boxes, so many shipping containers of new stuff to the United States. And they wanted to get those containers back to China so they could send Americans more new stuff. So what would happen is the shipping companies would massively discount those containers to sometimes around 10% of what it would cost to send something from China to the U.S. So it made it very cheap to send stuff there. But in a sense, it was a free ride because those containers were going back anyway. So many of the places that are buying used goods from developed countries sort of have that same relationship. Japan and Malaysia, Malaysia exports a lot of new stuff to Japan. Those containers need to get back to Malaysia. So why not fill them with used stuff? It's kind of, I always think of it as kind of almost like a carbon-free, free ride.
So your family, you had like three generations of people in the junk business?
Yeah, dating back to my great-grandfather.
Who came here and was a rag picker. What did that mean then?
Sure. Well, when he arrived in Galveston, Texas from Russia, he didn't speak English, didn't have any skills. He did what, you know, so many immigrants did. They literally started looking for value where no one else did, and that meant walking down the streets of Galveston looking for, you know, pieces of clothing that he could sell to a recycler. And as you, you know, get a few pennies in your pocket, then maybe you start going door to door and asking people, you know, at their doors, do you have some, you know, old clothes that you'd like to sell that I could buy? And then he would go and he would upsell those. If you're good at it, go from, you know, carrying around rags in a backpack to carrying them on a hand cart, to carrying them on a horse-drawn cart to a truck, and maybe at some point acquiring a piece of land where you can do this business. He eventually made his way up to Minneapolis. You know, he would deal in anything used, anything that other people didn't see value in, but he knew he could upsell in some way. And he ultimately started specializing in scrap metal. And so he founded a scrap metal business up in the Twin Cities.
And your family had a junkyard, too. Was that the scrap metal junkyard?
Yeah, the family junkyard, dating back to my great-grandfather, sort of split, and there were two. There's one still there, and my father, we actually had to sell off the old junkyard in Minneapolis because the city wanted the land. But my father, who just turned 78, he's in the business still, sort of still growing it.
In the scrap metal junk business, was there like a car flattener to
oh sure
junked
so
cars?
Yeah. I mean, you know, a scrapyard is, you know, the OSHA is probably going to hate this, but a scrapyard is a wonderful thing for a small child to grow up in. It's, you know, it's a wonderland, if you will. I loved as a kid watching our car flattener. You know, we were in the junk car business, and the cars would come in, and we'd pull out the motors, and then it would go into a flattener, and you'd see these cars flattened, and then they'd be piled up on trucks and driven, you know, to the steel mill where they'd be, you know, melted into new steel. We had a warehouse, which I loved to walk around, and, you know, I have very clear memories as a toddler walking around that warehouse and looking into boxes and barrels, and, you know, there would be plumber scrapper, there would be electrician scrapper, there would be, you know, defective molds from a factory that was making, you know, it could be, you know, figurines, brass figurines, and so it was a real wonderland, and as a child, it really impresses upon you that there is so much value out there in the world that other people don't see, and that value is an opportunity for yourself and your family.
Are there objects you've saved from your childhood when you were roaming through the junkyard?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the one of the great treasures I have, and I still can't believe I have it, is a sign from the Great Northern Railway, which is now a defunct railway. And there are railway collectors out there all over the world, and something like that is a real treasure. I have little animal figurines, brass figurines. We used to get a lot of those for some reason, and so we would always want to grab those. And you know, oftentimes the best stuff, it was stuff that I would find with my grandmother, who would take me out into the warehouse, and she would go snooping in the boxes, often much to the chagrin of my father, because he would worry about her out there. And we would find all kinds of, you know, of great things, oftentimes just figurines or you know, bits of toys, or just interesting, even I can remember just interesting brass plumbing scrap. You know, it'd be an odd-shaped pipe, and we'd grab it out of there just because we thought it'd be interesting to put on a shelf.
So I have a recycling question for you.
Sure.
I am really confused right now about what's happening to the plastics and paper that I recycle. I've heard that China isn't accepting our recycling anymore, at least not as much as they used to. I don't know where it's going instead. I'm not even sure which plastics are considered recyclable anymore and what kind of paper is going to not be recyclable because if it has certain finishes on it. It won't be recyclable. So I just feel like I'm going through the motions and I don't know if I'm really accomplishing anything. So help me out.
Sure. Well, you are definitely accomplishing something, and recycling is still a very good thing to do. Metals and paper are still widely recycled. There are still markets for them. They are not as strong as they used to be, and that's in large part because the global economy, and especially China's economy, has slowed down, and they were really the engine for buying that stuff and using it in new goods. But if you put, you know, a piece of paper, a piece of cardboard in your recycling clean bin, it's going to be recycled in some form, in some place. Some of it will be recycled in the United States, and there's more and more recycling capacity being built, you know, as we speak in the United States, and that's really exciting. And in terms of paper, I mean, I always recommend people follow the guidelines from your municipality or whoever runs your recycling program. You know, everybody has different markets. Every municipality has different markets, and they will tell you what they are capable of selling, you know, to mills and to, you know, whether they're domestic or overseas. Plastics, in some sense, is the same thing. You know, if they don't have markets for these kinds of plastics that you are generating at home, they're going to tell you whether or not that they can recycle it. And there are, you know, recycling programs in the United States who have started, you know, limiting the amount of plastics, the types of plastics that they will be willing to recycle. In terms of plastics that can be really easily recycled, the one that is easiest and there is always going to be some kind of robust market for is PET. So that's, you know, the bottles you get, whether it be a water bottle, a Coke bottle, and that can be used in any number of different applications from, you know, bottle-to-bottle recycling, if you will. It's also used in clothing. PET is, you know, is a type of polyester in a sense, and so it can be woven into clothing.
If you're unsure about a plastic, should you recycle it or not? If you recycle it and they can't use it, are you going to be ruining that whole batch?
So it depends on where you are, but generally, if you're unsure, I would say put it in the trash. And I know some of your listeners are going to hate hearing that, but the worst thing you can do to sort of your recycling program is to contribute what's known in the industry as contamination. So contamination just means it's a type of material that is not like the other materials. You have to think of recycling. Ultimately, your recycling is, it's not an environmental good. It's a commodity. And, you know, your recycling program is all about creating a commodity that it can sell to manufacturers. So if somebody is buying, you know, pure wood pulp to make into cardboard boxes, they certainly don't want a bunch of, you know, M&M's wrappers in it, not to pick on M&M's, but they don't want plastics in it. It makes it harder to manufacture. It may lower the quality of that wood pulp. And the same goes for, you know, a bunch of cardboard boxes, you know, that you may put into your recycling bin. The last thing you want is to have, you know, plastic wrappers in there that will make it harder to make a quality product from that cardboard. So, you know, in the first book, I described, you know, household recycling. It's not really recycling. Recycling is what happens at the paper mill. What you're doing in your home is harvesting. You're harvesting the stuff for the people who are actually doing the recycling. And so, in a sense, to be a good harvester of your recycling, you want to make things as clean and pure as you can.
Well, Adam Minter, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Minter is the author of the new book, Secondhand. The new movie, Uncut Gems, arrives on a wave of accolades from organizations including the National Board of Review, which named Adam Sandler the year's best actor, and the New York Film Critics Circle, which gave its Best Director Award to the filmmakers Josh and Benny Safdie. In the movie, Sandler plays a New York jewelry dealer who becomes embroiled in various desperate schemes to get out of debt. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Adam Sandler is known for his juvenile Hollywood comedies, but if you've seen him in movies like Punch Drunk Love and The Meyerowitz Stories, you know that he can be a superb dramatic actor when given the right material. He's found the right material and then some in Uncut Gems. Written and directed by the brothers Josh and Benny Safdie, this is a tense and jittery throwback to seedy New York crime classics such as The Gambler and Bad Lieutenant, about desperate men spiraling out of control. It's wildly entertaining and utterly excruciating, often at the same time. Sandler plays an impulsive, fast-talking Jewish businessman named Howard Ratner, who owns a jewelry store in Manhattan's Diamond District. We first meet him while he's having a colonoscopy, the movie's sly way of letting us know we're going to get uncomfortably up close and personal with this guy. It's also one of the few scenes in which the character isn't in motion. The story unfolds over a few chaotic days in the spring of 2012. Much of it takes place in his shop, where Howard peddles a lot of wares, like stolen Rolexes and diamond-studded Furby dolls, that are almost as flashy and dubious as he is, with his stud earrings, leather jacket, and dreadful goatee. But before long, Howard is on the move. He has a sports gambling habit that's cost him dearly, and loan sharks have started turning up at his store to collect. But Howard isn't just addicted to gambling. He's an adrenaline junkie, always ready to shift tactics and up the stakes without warning. Sandler's unpredictable energy gives the terrific supporting cast plenty to work with. Lakeith Stanfield plays a business associate who helps him hustle clients, while Julia Fox plays Howard's store clerk slash girlfriend, with whom he's forever fighting and patching things up. The shenanigans never stop. Work doesn't slow down for family occasions like a Passover Seder or his daughter's school play. Howard also has a beyond fed-up wife, played by Idina Menzel, whom he's about to divorce. But it's typical of his seat-of-the-pants approach and general obliviousness that on a whim, he asks her if she'll take him back.
I'm begging you, just give me another shot.
You know what, Howard?
Say yes, what?
I think you are the most annoying person I have ever met. I hate being with you, I hate looking at you, and if I had my way, I would never see you again.
It's because you're mad. You're mad, and it makes sense. You can punch me if you want.
Oh, thanks.
Hey, I was
Howard has hatched a typically wild scheme to pay off his debts. He plans to auction off some precious stones, the uncut gems of the title, which we've seen being stolen from an Ethiopian opal mine in the movie's prologue. In one sense, the jewels serve as a classic movie MacGuffin, a much-coveted treasure that changes hands rapidly throughout the story. But unlike most MacGuffins, the jewels are hardly irrelevant to the plot. They function as part of the movie's fierce moral critique, connecting Howard's wheeling and dealing antics to an exploitative industry with blood on its hands. One interested buyer is the Boston Celtics superstar Kevin Garnett, who thinks the gems could be just the good luck charm he needs in his next game. Garnett, who retired from pro basketball in 2016, isn't the only celebrity who gamely plays himself here. There's an amusing yet emotionally harrowing scene at a concert performance by the Canadian pop singer The Weeknd, who also gets briefly drawn into Howard's self-destructive orbit. As they've shown in their earlier nerve-jangling thrillers like Heaven Knows What and Good Time, the Safdie brothers have a talent for getting under your skin and staying there. They keep their camera closely trained on Howard, never allowing the audience any physical or psychological distance from him. The soundtrack is as abrasive as the camera work, an agitated symphony of radio chatter and raised voices. Howard never slows down, and neither does the movie. At times you may long for a breather, a moment's respite from the action. But there's something weirdly exhilarating about the movie's sustained intensity, the way it pulls you into this world of crooked capitalism run amok. And as cynical as Uncut Gems may be, it never feels soulless or devoid of feeling. The story was inspired by crazy tales the Safdies heard from their father, who used to work in the Diamond District. And while the movie isn't exactly nostalgic, its hard-edged realism is laced with affection. That love extends most of all to Howard himself. He may be insufferable, but Sandler makes him brilliantly insufferable. He taps into the rage, recklessness, and desperation that have underscored so many of his past comedic roles, and puts them so forcefully front and center that you can't take your eyes off him. Howard Ratner may indeed be the most annoying character you've met recently, and also the most memorable.
Justin Chang is a film critic at the LA Times. Coming up, we hear from Alex Borstein. She co-stars in the Amazon series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel as Susie Meyerson, the manager of housewife-turned-comedian Midge Maisel. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The third season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is now streaming on Amazon, and last Monday, the show was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Comedy Series. Our guest Alex Borstein won back-to-back Emmys for her performance as Mrs. Maisel's manager. She also won an Emmy for her performance in the Fox animated series Family Guy as the mother, Lois. On the HBO series Getting On, she played a nurse. She got her start on the sketch comedy series Mad TV. Alex Borstein spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, and they began with a clip from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's set in the 1950s. Midge Maisel is an affluent young Jewish housewife on New York's Upper West Side. After helping her husband, a businessman who's an aspiring comic, she takes the mic one night, likes it, and soon discovers she's a better comic than he is. Alex Borstein's character is the tough, streetwise Susie Meyerson, who recognizes Midge Maisel's talent and becomes her manager. In this scene from the second season, Midge Maisel's career has gotten some traction, and she's meeting Susie at a diner. Midge Maisel is played by Rachel Brosnahan. The scene begins with Borstein, as Susie, remarking that Midge's success means her phone calls are now being returned.
These club owners call me back in a flash. Sometimes I hear them yell, take a message. When they hear it's me on the phone, they take the call. That's respect. For me. I mean, look at me. They're respecting me. I'm looking at you. Alone, I am a spittoon. With you, I'm a somebody.
That's not true, Susie. They respect you because they fear you. You're great at what you do.
Half of them respect me, maybe. The other half want to get in your pants.
Oh, stop.
It's gonna happen. I mean, look at you. It's like a dollop of whipped cream grew a head.
Just don't undercut yourself. That's all I'm saying.
So, you called this lunch? What do you want to talk about?
I just wanted to touch base before I go to the Catskills. We leave tomorrow.
Cool.
God, it's gonna be so nice to have a break. This past year has been tough. What's this?
Gigs. My interpreter lost its S. That's why it says Saturday, Unday. You went to college. You can figure it out.
These are all in the next 2 weeks.
So?
I'm going to the Catskills.
Yeah, you said.
So I can't do these. I'm going to the Catskills.
First one's not till a week after next.
But I'm going to the Catskills.
Yeah, your record's skipping, Missy. Get to the point.
I'm going to the Catskills for 2 months.
Jeez, I almost did a spit take.
Almost? That was a spit take.
You're going to the Catskills for 2 months?
I told you a million times I was going to the Catskills.
Yeah, but I figured it was 5 days tops, not 2 months.
You got the guy in back of me, too.
What the hell do you do up there for 2 months?
Lots of things.
What things? You look at a tree, you go to bed. You get up, you look at a tree. You're gonna do that for 2 straight months? What the f*** is going on up there?
There's activities. We go boating, we sunbathe. What do you do for the summer?
I stay here, and I sweat, and I smell like a bum. And I'm miserable, and I want to kill people, and I do that till it gets cold.
And that's our guest, Alex Borstein, with Rachel Brosnahan in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The third season is now available for streaming on Amazon Prime. Alex Borstein, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you. Tell us about Susie, this manager. You know, I'm sure you spent a lot of time in comedy clubs. Was there somebody that you kind of drew on for this character?
You know, not directly. This character just feels very familiar, regardless of what profession and what world she's working in. It's you know, she's my grandmother, she's my mother, she's people like Amy Sherman-Palladino in my life. There have been, you know, various club owners that you know, throughout the years, but there's no one person. I know Amy, in bringing this to life, she did pull from a, you know, Sue Manger's kind of a character, too, and The women that have risen to the top, and especially during that time, were pretty few and far between and very recognizable.
This series has really high production values, and the costumes, especially for the women, are like, wow, down to the hat and the gloves. You look pretty different.
Yeah, most of the women have extravagant costumes. I'm the lucky one, I think. I get flat shoes. No girdle. You know, I'm not forced to wear period underpinnings. I think I am supposed to wear. I do have one vintage bra, but many, many times I actually sneak my own bra under because it's hidden with a jacket and they can't see. And Susie's is not extravagant. Her bra is a sad little white old 1950s period piece. But yeah, a lot of times out of laziness, I'll keep on my maiden form and move forward.
You know, as I understand it, this was created by Amy Sherman-Palladino, who you'd worked with before, and you were living in Barcelona, right? You'd kind of made a move, and then you got this script.
She sucked me back in. Yeah, I decided to, I wanted my kids to do, you know, a school year abroad and wanted to have that experience and had just, I had worked on a show called Getting On, which was the love of my life.
Yeah.
And that ended, and it broke my heart, and I was just, had tried with another project to get it off the ground, and then that looked like it was going to happen, and it fell apart, something with Alan Arkin, and I just kind of gave up. I thought, I'm just done. I want to enjoy my time and not feel terrible about myself. Let me just go and have this experience. And right then, Amy's like, are you still serious about doing this Spain thing? Because I've written that project I talked to you about, and I'd really like for you to read for this. So I was like, well, go ahead and send it. And then I read it, and I was like, why did I have her send it? Because I loved it, and I couldn't not audition for it, so I auditioned for it.
So what was the audition like?
I flew into New York. I brought some clothing that felt like what I kind of envisioned for this character, like a button-down shirt and some brown wool, I don't know if you'd call them dungarees, trousers, some flat kind of men's suit shoes. And they had me read with Rachel. So I met Rachel that day. And it was very warm, and I threw the outfit on and realized right while I was in the waiting room I forgot deodorant. And just sweat pit circles, like really awful, awful sweat pits. And I think they actually thought it was kind of charming and very Susie-ish.
There's a lot of stand-up in the series, I mean, in comedy clubs and in other settings. And, you know, it struck me that that's maybe not the easiest thing to recreate. I mean, kind of the feeling of a comedy club and the spontaneity of a performer and an audience in a scripted drama. Did you feel that way?
It's the hardest thing in the world to do. I think we were all most nervous about that. And almost every show or movie I've ever seen about stand-up, just there's something so stiff and so unreal. And I think what Amy nailed was making Midge a type of stand-up that you have not seen before in that era. You know, she's not a Lenny Bruce, but she's stream of consciousness, and she's talking about things she's not supposed to and not doing a character, not... So I think that made it a little bit easier that she's presenting herself and performing pieces from her life, that maybe lends itself to reproducing in an easier way. And Rachel's very, very committed to, I mean, nailing it. She works very, very hard on that material and asks a lot of questions, and Amy guides her a lot, and she tries different things. And we're very lucky that the background players who play our audiences, I mean this, they're really dedicated, and they laugh many, many, many times. We do so many takes, and they're able to give us the feeling that it's very real and give her the feeling that it's very real, that when she's succeeding, it feels real. She's able to have the right tone to follow up a joke with something that's just gone over well. And if you don't have that from the people responding to you, it's hard to pretend.
Yeah, you take for granted those people that are out there in these chairs, but it's a long day for them.
Very long day. In wool, in corsets, in heel, very uncomfortable shoes from the 50s and hats, and it is a tremendous amount of work for them.
Did you do a lot of stand-up when you were younger?
I've done some stand-up, you know. Really, I was just so desperate to perform and wanting desperately to just get up on stage and try to do stuff and please, that stand-up was a great shortcut to do that. You didn't have to wait for a notice for an audition or try to get a group of people together. You could just go and do. And the first time I did it, I was 16 years old, and it was at a bar that my parents had to come with me because they wouldn't let me in the bar otherwise. It was in the Valley in California, and they paid me $20 at a place called Gallagher's. It was in the bottom of the Ramada Inn.
Wow.
And, you know, my material was about parents and school and teachers, and I'm sure maybe it was a little bit cute. I don't know how great it was, but the six people in the audience were very kind. And it's funny, I made $20, and I think that was maybe the only money I ever made. After that, every, like, open mic was, you know, no one ever paid me again, really.
Wow. Do you remember any of your jokes?
I remember talking about the toilet paper in the bathrooms. The junior high bathrooms were, in an effort to save paper and be economical, they looked like teeny tiny squares that came out as a single piece instead of a roll of toilet paper. And I was comparing the size of the paper to the size of my ass and making jokes about how this, from the little math that I understood, this does not seem to work. I didn't say it was funny, folks. I said I did it at 16. Most of it was family. Most of it was me impersonating my grandmother or talking about my parents, or that was the bulk of my material.
You grew up in the suburbs in Illinois and then moved to the L.A. area for high school. Were you always a cut-up? Were you always making jokes as a kid?
You know, I was always the comic relief in the family. I think you get a role at a very early age, and that's kind of what you're stuck with. And that was my role. We We were always kind of a funny family, but specifically I would kind of try to ease tensions a lot of time.
Now, you were the youngest of three, right? And
yeah.
your brother is a hemophiliac.
Yes, one of them.
You were not? You carry the gene, but you don't have the disorder? Is that right?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When I grew up, women, even if you had a low level of clotting factor, which I do, they just called us low-level symptomatic carriers. You're a carrier. But now I have a daughter who has the same, you know, factor level as me, and now she's actually in the category. They call her a mild hemophiliac. So, yeah, but growing up, I was always just called a symptomatic carrier and really never had any issues. I never had to be treated for it. But my brother, you know, lived the life of a hemophiliac, my uncle as well, and so that was something that I think I provided a lot of comic relief, you know, making him laugh, you know, when he had to be, you know, hospitalized for long periods of time, or if he was in a wheelchair, or we would have wheelchair races in the hospital corridors. We, at one point, he was in a wheelchair, and we tied a rope to the back of his wheelchair and to the garage door handle, and thought that would be hilarious to open the garage and close the garage and have it pull him up and down the driveway, which of course ended up was not a good idea, folks. I'm going to go ahead and say, don't do that.
don't do this. Don't try this at home. So what happened? Did it spill him out of the chair?
Of course, he spilled out of the chair. It you know, when the thing went up, you know, it was disastrous. He rolled down and then it yanked back when it went higher, and he poured out onto the cement driveway, and we were in a lot of trouble. But I think he laughed his ass off, so it was worth it. It was worth the injury.
Do you think seeing the difficulties your brothers faced and spending as much time as you did in medical settings and hospitals, I'm wondering how that affected you, your sense of, I don't know, security?
I don't know. I mean, definitely seeing the fragility of life, definitely seeing that one mutation of one gene can completely change the course of your health or a person's destiny, or I think that was always something that stayed with me, and I've, as a result, I've been very, very active in the hemophilia community. When I was pregnant with my first child, I knew that it was a boy, and I was terrified that he was going to be a hemophiliac. I was terrified, and what that would mean, and would I be able to handle it, and I've since stayed very active. I reached out to the community at that point and talked to a lot of moms of hemophiliacs to try to figure out what kind of life, what is this going to mean for me now? Because I knew what it was like for my brother growing up, but it's changed. Treatment is very different now. My brother, you know, lost so many friends to HIV because the product was tainted. It is a blood derivative, and a lot of it was contaminated and still distributed within the
community. Oh, you mean hemophiliacs who were treated with blood treatments that were contaminated?
That's right. The factor VIII treatment required for hemophilia, if you have hemophilia A, was tainted. There was a lot of hepatitis C and HIV, and so many people died. So many people were lost, and we lived with that fear. We were very lucky. For some reason, my brother was spared and did not contract HIV. But it was very tenuous and very scary. That was always kind of a weight.
We're speaking with Alex Borstein. She co-stars in the series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel as Susie Meyerson. The third season is now available for streaming on Amazon Prime. Your grandmother was Hungarian, right? A Holocaust survivor as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to Hebrew school too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of sounds in your head. Did you develop mm-hmm. characters out of all that?
Yeah, I think you know, I worked on a show called Mad TV, and one of the other actors, Will Sasso, he grew up with a second language in his house. And I think having that lends itself to impersonations, voices, character development. I think it's something that has a hand in pointing you in that direction. So yeah, having different languages and ways to shape your mouth, I think it absolutely helped push me in that direction.
Do you have a character from your childhood that you remember or can share with us?
I mean, my grandmother was, you know, someone that I impersonated all my life. She then became, you know, a character I ended up doing on Mad TV. I was doing in live theater before, that was first called The Other Gabor, and then she became Miss Swan. And
uh-huh.
So that was
you know, why you eat so much candy? Have a candy. Here, eat a candy. I make for you cake. Why you eat cake? You fat, too fat.
There was a lot of that. There right. was a lot of, I mean, I watched a lot of, you know, Latka on Taxi was uh-huh. major for me to watch something like that. And Jonathan Winters. There were a lot of things that right. became little voices in my head.
Is celebrity appealing and fun? I mean, do you enjoy people approaching you in the airport and on the street?
I'm not really good at it. I'm not good at it. I still have a really crap self-image, and I think I still live in like a middle school mentality in my head. So if anyone's looking at me, I assume it's because they are making fun of me. If anyone's whispering, I assume it's because they're saying terrible things. So it's I get very paranoid and strange about it, and my face will turn red, and I get very uncomfortable. And I think I come off 9 times out of 10 as very aloof, but I'm uncomfortable with it. It's strange.
So maybe Barcelona's an advantage in that way.
Yeah, the thing I always say what I love most about Barcelona is I get to be anonymous there, but I feel very visible and alive and seen and taken in well. And whereas when I'm here, I feel very invisible in some ways. Or if people are looking at me, it's probably for the wrong reasons and nervous about it. I know it makes no sense, but that's why I'm an actor. We're all nuts, right?
Alex Borstein, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Alex Borstein spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. She's won 2 Emmys for her performance in the series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and the show is nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Comedy Series. The 3rd season is now streaming on Amazon. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.